Okay, we're ready for chapter 6, the book of Proverbs. Chapter 5 began a warning about how to be kept from the strange woman, verse 3, and talked about her ways being changeable. Talks about the penalty a person pays in the end when they are destroyed in hell and didn't obey, and then it talks about marriage as a refreshing well that you drink out of your own spring. And then starting in chapter 6, one commentary mentions, in order to secure the peace and happiness of married life, the teacher is just so highly commended, he now cautions his pupil against two evils that often bring great distress on families, reducing them to poverty, namely inconsiderate suretyship and slothfulness. So not losing the continuity of thought as you go through the book of Proverbs, since this is all in the same book. Chapter 6 now warns, my son, picking up an introduction we touched on earlier, if you be surety for your friend, if you have stricken your hand with a stranger, now, this is certainly a warning about getting yourself indebted financially, primarily in the sense of becoming responsible for someone else's character. So he warns against being surety. Now, he doesn't say anything about brother, because a brother's obligation is to take care of the near of kin, whether they're blind or crippled or handicapped or whatever they are. So if you notice it obviously in addressing friend and stranger, leaves out brother or kinfolk, but it isn't wise, no matter how well you think you know someone, to sign on the dotted line for them. Because in doing so, you're predicting their character and their future. And of course, nobody can do that. So the Bible seems to be quite vigorous about suretyship. You can end up selling your wife and family into an indebtedness, a type of slavery, by being surety for someone and then not being able to make it good by your material goods. Then you and your family have to go into work for them until you pay off the indebtedness. So notice how vigorously God considers, if you get yourself in a bind like that, how you should do. Of course, striking your hand is like we shake hands on a bargain. Job 17, verse 3, if you want to jot down another scripture that kind of gives you the definition there. Now notice what he says next. If you've already gone that far, and you've become surety, and you've stricken your hand, you are snared with the words of your mouth. Your sayings have already trapped you. You're taken with the words of your mouth. Do this now, my son, and rescue and deliver yourself. When you come into the hand of your friend, go humble yourself and make sure you're a friend. So once you realize you made a mistake, then see if you can get your friend to relieve you from a suretyship. And you know, this is a good counsel about someone who's called when they're in the military. If you can go and be relieved from your commitment to 3 years or 4 years or whatever, then you can be God's freedman. Of course, you couldn't desert and violate your vow and your word when you signed in. But it's good wisdom that way about maybe you signed an agreement to contribute so much a month in the Baptist church for the next 10 years. So you can go get yourself out of that bind, and surely they'd relieve you from that. So when you're come into the hand of your friend, go humble yourself and make sure your friend, and notice how serious it is. Don't give sleep to your eyes or slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself as a roe from the hand of the hunter. The swiftness and the agility of the roe, as that delivers him from the hand of the hunter, so someone who's become in surety should deliver himself as a bird from the hand of the fowler, someone that catches the fowl. So that's a five-verse warning about not signing on the dotted line for somebody else's debts. Now, I've known of people that ignored that and thought they knew somebody well enough that they'd sign for somebody else's debts, and it worries you, and you can't predict somebody's character. There's no way you can anticipate what could happen to them. So it's fairly well worded. You're snared and taken with your words. So don't get any sleep till you get yourself out of that mess. Now he comes to another section. Go to the ant, you sluggard. So he's not telling all of us to go to the ant. And some of us have inherited the nature that we might not need to go to the ant to learn. But others of us perhaps would have to learn that way. So the Bible isn't saying everybody ought to study the ant and learn a lesson from the ant, but a sluggard should. Consider her ways and be wise. And this is one little scripture that became a giant in a critical analysis of the Bible, because God takes the critics in their own craftiness. You know, there are plenty of scriptures that show God takes the wise in their own craftiness. And over again, you find that proven. And I think God did that on purpose. A lot of the critics that came up in Germany back in the 1800s primarily and began to doubt and criticize the Bible, God allowed them to get their neck stuck all the way out like a turtle, and then God caused archaeology to come on the scene and began to chop necks off. So here's another neck that got chopped off. Notice what he says about the ant, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler. You know, they're not like some other creatures that have a leader or have a captain or a head of their clan or the roughest, oldest, biggest creature that rules the group. The ant, which having no guide, overseer, ruler, provides her meat in the summer. Now, the critics get caught in the ant den because right away they say the word meat here actually comes from the Hebrew word that most places refers to grain. And who ever heard of ants storing up grain? Provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. Now, in contrast to the ant, of course, the sluggard might tend to say, well, I don't have anybody to drive me. I don't have anybody to rule me or push me or give me the ambition or to inspire me or encourage me. So the suggestion is a sluggard might give that excuse. And yet God says, well, you know, the ant doesn't have anybody to push it either. It has no guide, overseer, or ruler. So then he shows the description of the sluggard. How long will you sleep, O sluggard? When will you arise out of your sleep? Now, in the sense of the word sleep, he doesn't necessarily mean here how many hours you're sawing the logs. You know, the sleep can mean you're sleeping from work. You're sleeping from activity. You're sleeping from energy. It doesn't necessarily mean you lie around on the sack 20 hours a day. How long will you sleep, O sluggard? When will you arise out of your sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come. Of course, there are six different words that are translated poverty or poor in the book of Proverbs. One word is the word rush, R-U-S-H. That word just means in want of necessaries of life. In want of necessaries or necessities of life. A second word translated poor or poverty is the word dal, D-A-L, which means impoverished or reduced. A third word, heser, H-E-S-E-R, that means in want. I might give you a few places that one's used. Chapter 11, verse 24. chapter 21, verse 17, chapter 28, verse 22. A fourth word that means is translated that way is the word Hanai, which means wretched, chapter 14, verse 21. Another word, Habion, which means destitute or helpless, deficient in will and wealth, chapter 14 and verse 31. And the last word literally means dispossessed, Yarish, Y-A-R-A-S-H. So someone that's become so poor that they sold themselves as a slave and got dispossessed from their property. Chapter 20, verse 13. Chapter 23, verse 21. And chapter 30, verse 9. Now, the other words are used so many times, I won't try to give you the other places they're used. This particular word here is the word that means in need, or the first word, the rush. So your poverty shall come as one that travels. In other words, someone always having to move from place to place to place, like a nomad, just seeking an existence, seeking enough to stay alive, seeking something a little better than you had the last time. And your want as an armed man. Now that's the end of that particular admonition. And I want to read a little bit out of the Whedon commentary about this statement about the ant, because it's very informative. The ant has, in all ages, been a favorite illustration in the inculcation of the duties of industry, diligence, and forethought, because these little insects are among the most notable examples of the instinctive operation of the principles above inculcated. But the latest researchers of naturalists indicate that the European ant doesn't store up grain for the winter, as has been commonly supposed. It's generally torpid in winter and needs no food. Perhaps in warmer climates the case may be different. European ants remain active all winter if they're put in hothouses. They're said to become torpid at 27 degrees. Now, when it talks about providing her meat, the original is used of any kind of food, but especially denotes grain. So it's roundly asserted that no European ants feed on any kind of grain. They're altogether carnivorous. But Bennett found, however long they'd been kept without food, they wouldn't touch corn or grain. Nor has any species of ant been yet found with food of any kind laid up in its nest. These are certainly extraordinary statements, indicating not only may popular opinion be wrong, but that a host of learned men in all ages have been in error. Aristotle made similar mistakes like Solomon did here. Pliny, Horace, Plutarch, Virgil, Juvenal, St. Jerome, as well as Solomon, may be quoted as authority for the fact that ants do lay up food in store for the future. It's true Solomon does not say what kind of food the ant provides, but only that she provides food in the summer and in the harvest. So he quotes Horace, "The ant, small as she is, sets us an example. She's very laborious. She carries in her mouth whatever she can and adds it to her constructed store heap, providing against the future period with great precaution. The white ants or termites, so abundant in tropical countries, do, according to reliable authority, store up food in their nests or houses. It's moreover admitted by some that ants do carry various things to their nests, as portions of leaves, kernels of grain. Not, however, for food is asserted, but because they have a fancy for them. They are great robbers," says Thompson in The Land and the Book. "They plunder by night and by day, and a farmer must keep a sharp eye on his threshing floor, or they will abstract a large quantity of grain in a single night." And he refers you to the article Ant in McClintock and Strong. So, you know, God didn't say in Solomon's location in Palestine, all you proved was Solomon didn't know beans from apple butter about European ants. You know, you just proved he was in Palestine, in the Middle East. And he didn't talk about European ants. To make this note the more complete, from Popular Science Monthly, Mr. Moggridge has recently, by careful observation in the south of Europe, confirmed in many of their minutest details the accounts given by ancient writers as to the ants being eaters of grain. He describes the ants as ascending the stalks of cereals and gnawing off the grains, while others below detached the seed from the chaff and carried it home, as gnawing off the radical to prevent germination, and as spreading their stores in the sun to dry them after wet weather. These statements he has verified, supplementing them by discovering the granaries in which they are stored, sometimes excavated in solid rock. He's seen them in the art of collecting seeds, has traced seeds to the granaries. He's seen them bring out the grains to dry after a rain, and nibble off the radical from those which were germinating. Lastly, he's seen them feed on the seed so collected. Their depredations are of such extent as much cause serious loss to cultivators. The most wonderful ant in the world is one, so far as known, found only in the United States. Its scientific name is Ophthalmophysians, popularly called the stinging ant, on account of the pungency of its venom. And guess where that most wonderful ant in the world is? Texas. California. Anyway, they're probably all over the U.S. Its habits have been thoroughly studied for 12 years by Dr. Lincecum of Texas. Now, can you imagine spending 12 years of your life studying ants? And the results communicated to the Linnaean Society by Charles Darwin. The following is an abstract of Dr. Lincecum's communication. It's a large brownish ant. He names it the agricultural ant. It dwells in what may be called paved cities, and like a thrifty farmer, makes suitable arrangements for the changing seasons. When it has selected a situation for its habitation, if on dry ground, it bores a hole around which it raises the surface 3 and sometimes 6 inches, forming a low circular mound, having a very gentle inclination from the center to the outer border, which on an average is 3 or 4 feet from the entrance. But if the location is on low, flat, wet land, liable to inundation, though perfectly dry at the time the ant sets to work, it nevertheless elevates the mound in the form of a pretty sharp cone to the height of 15 to 20 inches or more and makes the entrance near the summit. Around the mound, in either case, the ant clears the ground of all obstructions, levels and smooths the surface to the distance of 3 or 4 feet from the gate of the city, giving the space the appearance of a handsome pavement, as it really is. Within this paved area, not a blade of any green thing is allowed to grow except a single species of grain-bearing grass. Having planted this crop in a circle around, so not only do these ants store up, they actually plant and garden. Having planted this crop in a circle around, 2 or 3 feet from the center of the mound, the insect tends and cultivates it with constant care, cutting away all other grasses and weeds that may spring up amongst it and around it, outside of the farm circle to the extent of 1 or 2 feet more. The cultivated grass grows luxuriantly and produces a heavy crop of small white flinty seeds, which under the microscope very closely resemble ordinary rice. When ripe, it's carefully harvested and carried by the workers, chaff and all, into the granary cells, where it's divested of the chaff and packed away. The chaff is taken out and thrown beyond the limits of the paved area. During protracted wet weather, it sometimes happens that the provision stores become damp, and they're liable to sprout and spoil. In this case, on the first fine day, the ants bring out the damp and moistened grain and expose it to the sun till it's dry. When they carry it back again and pack away all the sound seeds, leaving those that had sprouted to waste. There can be no doubt of the fact that the particular species of grain-bearing grass is intentionally planted. In farmer-like manner, the ground is carefully divested of all other grasses and weeds during the time it's growing. When it's ripe, the grain is taken care of, the dry stubs cut away and carried off, the paved area being left unencumbered till the ensuing autumn, when the same ant rice reapers, or ant rice, reappears within the same circle and receives the same agricultural attention as the previous crop, and so on from year to year. as I know to be the case in all situations where the ant settlements are protected from graminivorous animals. In a second letter, in answering to inquiries from Dr. Darwin, Mr. Darwin, whether he supposed the ants planted the seeds for the ensuing crop, Dr. L. says, "I have not the least doubt of it. My conclusions are not from hasty or careless observation, nor from seeing the ants do something that looked like it and then guessing at the results. I have at all seasons watched the same ant cities during the last 12 years, and I know what I stated in my former letter is true. I visited the same cities yesterday and found the crop of ant rice growing finely and exhibiting also the signs of high cultivation, and not a blade of any other kind of grass or weed was seen within 12 inches of the circular row of ant rice." The author of the book remarks that the economical habits of this wonderful insect far surpass anything that Solomon has written of the ant. And it's not too much to say that if any of the scriptural writers had ventured to speak of an ant that not only laid up stores of grain, but actually prepared the soil for the crop, planted the seed, kept the ground free from weeds, and finally reaped the harvest, the statement would have been utterly disbelieved, and the credibility not only of that particular writer, but of the rest of Scripture severely damaged. And it's kind of like that little kid that came home from Sunday school, and his mom said, "Well, what'd they teach you?" And he said, "Well, Moses came to this Red Sea, you know, and he got out the ships and the cannons and the trucks, you know, and they began to take the people across the sea and withstand the enemy." And the mom said, "Well, Johnny, now come on, you know good and well at him what they told you." He said, "Well, you really wouldn't believe if I told you what they really said." So, you know, if Solomon had told you all this about the ant, then certainly nobody would have believed it. Solomon's statement concerning the ant has afforded one of the stock arguments against the truth of Scripture. And yet we have his statements not only corroborated the very letter by those who visited Palestine for the express purpose of investigating its zoology, but far surpassed by the observations of a scientific man of the U.S. who'd watched the insects for a series of years. Now, in the going back here to the chapter once again, in verse 11, where he says, "So shall your poverty come as one that travels," the word rendered poverty seems to imply the kind of poverty that comes by the loss of possessions. So he's saying that's the way you're going to even lose what you inherited. That's the way you're going to even lose what you thought you had. Now, when he mentions here your want as an armed man, so shall your poverty come as one that travels, and your want as an armed man, the Hebrew literally means man of the shield. So there probably is an allusion here to messengers of death or the executioners, which were sent by Eastern monarchs to take off a man's head without note or warning, right wherever he found him, in the house or in the way. So that's what he's saying here. If you're a sluggard, your life is going to be taken as if it were by one of these executioners that was sent to take your life. It'll be just as sure, no matter where you are. Now in verse 12, picking up a new story flow or a new context, a naughty person. Now you might jot down another scripture. Notice back in Job chapter 12 about the ant, as well as other creatures. Job 12, verse 7 and 8, "Ask now the beasts, and they shall teach you. Ask the fowls of the air, they'll tell you. Speak to the earth, it'll teach you. The fishes of the sea, they'll declare to you. Who knows not in all these that the hand of the Eternal has wrought this?" So that isn't a new idea of going to a creation of God to learn lessons that man needs to learn. Proverbs chapter 30 and verse 25, one other scripture you might tie in with that. Verse 24, there are four things little upon the earth, but exceeding wise. The ants, a people not strong, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. The conies, rabbits, hares, a feeble folk, yet they make their houses in the rocks. You know, rabbits don't have any claws. How do they get any holes in the rocks for dens? The locusts have no king, yet go they forth, all of them, by bands, gathered together in a swarm. Somebody in the middle calling the signals, got a quarterback among locusts? No, they have no king. The spider takes hold with her hands, and yet little bitty spiders in king's palaces. Now, in the statement back here about how long will you sleep, O sluggard, a little sleep, a little slumber, you might want to jot down chapter 24 and verse 33, another passage parallel to that. I went by the field of the slothful, by the vineyard the man void of understanding, all grown over with thorns, nettles had covered the face thereof, the stone wall thereof was broken down. Then I saw and considered it well. Now, you know, I've noticed that when I visit people that are new and prospects for the church. And I know I used to get a letter to visit, and you'd go out visiting, and you'd see a house, and you'd think, well, I hope that one isn't it. And sure enough, it was a lot of times. And others you'd see, and you'd say, oh, I hope that's them, and that sure enough, it was sometimes. But no matter how you start out in the church, maybe when you go by at the beginning, that's a good description of it. But by the time they're in the church a while, you'll see it differently. Well, he says, then I saw and considered well, I looked upon and received instruction, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come as one that travels, and your want as an armed man. So the very same words are exactly repeated again in another section of the same Proverbs. One other verse you might tie in with those, chapter 10 and verse 5. He that gathers in summer is a wise son, and he that sleeps in harvest is a son that causes shame. So again, paralleling the ant, he that gathers in summer is a wise son. Make hay while the sun shines, the proverb we have. So you'd want to mark a dollar bill sign here somewhere. I've got it after verse 11 about poverty. Of course, you want to mark my son as you go through here. In fact, it's wise to even chain that terminology. Okay, coming on to chapter, or verse 12 in chapter 6. Here again, 1611 language is misleading. A naughty person. Now, Hebrew is man of Belial. It actually is the Anglo-Saxon word, nay, which means no or not, and wit, no thing, not a thing, not. That's what the term is, a worthless person. Someone that's not or empty. Moron, you might say, or whatever we... A naughty person, a wicked man, and here the particular word for wicked is literally the crooked nature or vanity of your very being, the sin of the flesh, of the members, walks with a forward mouth, walks with a perverse mouth. So a man that's vain and has the sin in his members, as well as a empty person, a worthless, nothing person, may have a big mouth and a know-it-all mouth. He winks with his eyes, closes his eyes to some things, and opens them to other things. He speaks with his feet. He teaches with his fingers. Now, of course, back in those days when they wore sandals, and if you're in a room and the host is there and you want to make some comment to one of the guests, you might just do it with your toes. which they did, you know. They gave messages by their feet and toes. They didn't attract attention, but just pointing to somebody. Winks with his eyes, speaks with his feet, teaches with his fingers. Frowardness is in his heart. Now, this is a different word. This word means deceitfulness. We've run into this same word, chapter 2, verses 12 and 14. You'll get it again in chapter 8 and verse 13. But here it means deceitfulness, trickery, is in his heart. He devises mischief continually. He sows discord. Therefore shall his calamity come suddenly. Suddenly he'll be broken without remedy. So there again, verses 12 through 15 are one message about the vain, empty-headed, sarcastic, forward mouth, and what happens to someone like that. Somebody that'll never learn, or their calamity comes suddenly, they're suddenly broken without remedy. But a man's known by his mouth, by his speech. You know, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So if forwardness is in his heart, it's going to show through his mouth. So don't think you can just always explain or forget how someone says things and what they say and say, well, they mean well, you know, or they got a good heart, or, you know, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So those verses are a good warning to that. Now in verse 16, this is a type of Hebrew writing that comes quite often in the Bible. These six does the Eternal hate, yea, seven are an abomination to him. Of course, they're not six of one thing and seven of another. They're just saying six or seven things that God hates and are abomination. So that instead of giving an exact number, they're just saying, you know, the list isn't to be exact, but there are any number you can come up with that are things God hates and that are an abomination to God. Now, you'll notice a little later he talks about a righteous man hates iniquity or evil. So he introduces you to that by saying to you, yeah, there are things even God hates. In fact, there are six or seven things that he not only hates, but yea, they're even an abomination. And here again unto him is really the word naphesh. So these six or seven things are an abomination to God's soul. Now, even God has a soul. To God himself, to his own soul, they're an abomination. So that's another good verse for soul. A proud look, and the Hebrew literally means eyes lifted up. That's mentioned many times in the Bible. A lying tongue. So he starts off with your brain and down to your tongue and then down to your hands and ends up at your feet. So it's obvious he's giving you a total analysis from the head to the foot. Your eyes, then your tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief. A false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among brethren. Now, some of those you might not lump as being as bad as others. We humanly tend to think hands that shed innocent blood, that'd be the worst of all. And yet God actually lists a proud look first, and a lying tongue secondly, and then hands that shed innocent blood thirdly, a heart that devises wicked imaginations fourth, feet that be swift in running to mischief, and then a false witness that speaks lies, and then sowing discord among brethren. Now, you know, that's one that almost everybody is guilty of, because so many times people talk about somebody to another person, and that isn't going to do them any good. That's a good passage to memorize. You know, anybody ought to want to know the six or seven things God hates that are an abomination to God. So whether it's a little pink lie or little gray lies or little white lies, you know, God doesn't color lies. He talks about two different things. Lying and bearing false witness are two different things listed here. You know, in the New Testament, there's one verse back in Paul's writings. You'd never know it in the King James language, but there's actually a term that means lying that literally in the Greek means exaggerating. You know, exaggerating just to make somebody else come over to your opinion. Overstating something to get someone else to conform their view to your view. Maybe you never thought of that as lying before, but that's one of the words, one of the types of ways you can lie. So there are a lot more ways of lying than you might think. Well, picking up a new section then, verse 20, another one of the my son sections. My son, keep your father's commandment, and don't forsake the law of your mother. Now, we ran into something very similar to that back in the first chapter. If you want to tie those two together, verse 8 of chapter 1. Keep your father's commandment, and don't forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart, and tie them about your neck. Now, of course, that didn't mean physically that we're to wear some kind of a necklace, a cross, or to wear some kind of a leather necklace around our neck, and in that we have a commandment and a law that we don't ever keep otherwise, but it's always there tapping on your heart, and it's always up here tapping on your mind. You know, having the physical reminder doesn't do you a bit of good if you don't abide by what they're supposed to remind you of. So circumcision in itself was worthless unless you abided by what circumcision was only a token of. Circumcision was not a covenant by itself, but a token of a covenant. So if you bind them continually on your heart and tie them about your neck, and certainly what he just gave up above, the six things God hates, the seven that are an abomination, would be among those that you'd want to bind continually on your heart and tie about your neck. When you go, you can be led by this fact that you've gotten them bound about your heart and your neck. When you sleep, you'll be peaceful. You won't worry about, you know, the wicked flee when none pursues. But if you're not wicked, you're binding God's commandments and laws, then you can sleep, and God's saints have sweet sleep. When you sleep, it'll keep you. When you awake, it'll talk with you. In other words, it'll come back again into your heart and into your mind. And if you do your part about binding them continually on your heart and neck, because the commandment is a lamp. So it's like the flashlight at night. It's like the dad lantern or the Coleman lantern. The commandment is a lamp. The law is light. I wonder how Protestants that do away with the law would ever explain that. He wasn't talking about the new commandments of Jesus way back there. Reproofs of instruction are the way to life, not the way of life. People didn't want you to think they had life offered back in the Old Testament, and yet they certainly did. There's one interesting point I might go back and mention about the six or seven things God hates and that are an abomination. If you parallel these with the things in Matthew 5, there are seven things listed back there. The Beatitudes, blessed, happy are the people. So in contrast with what God hates and are abomination, there are the seven blessed things of God too. So in these, interestingly enough, the first one and the last of these seven are identical in those two lists. God hates a proud look, but what does it say back in Matthew 5? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Then the last one back here in Proverbs 6, he that sows discord among brethren. So what's the seventh one in Matthew 5? Blessed are the peacemakers. So Christ must have been thinking back into Proverbs 6 when he contrasted these seven things listed here with the opposites of these as to the things that are blessed in God's sight in comparison to those things that are an abomination and that God hates. Another numerical interesting thing, when you look at the terminology about false witness, that occurs six times right here in the book of Proverbs, which again, man's number. And now, going on anyway here in chapter 6, and when you go, you'll be led by these. When you sleep, they'll keep you. And when you awake, they'll be in your mind. You'll be reminded of them. They'll keep you from the evil woman, verse 24, the normal word rea, from the flattery of the tongue of a strange woman. Now here again, the Hebrew word is naker, which means alien or foreign woman. You're supposed to be married to Christ. You're supposed to be following the church, the mother, and you're supposed to be one within the church. But God's laws and commandments then keep you from the alien woman, the false woman, from a foreign woman that isn't God's woman, the virgin church. Don't lust after her beauty in your heart. Now, that's what a lot of people do. They say, oh, I just miss that old Baptist church. Old stained glass windows and the little white church in the vale and a little brown church on the hill and, you know, all those sentimental songs we used to sing. And boy, oh boy, do you ever do that? Don't lust after her beauty in your heart. Some of the most beautiful buildings on earth are churches. Some of the most dominant buildings in cities, the Cologne Cathedral or St. Peter's or whatever, that's not beautiful. Except maybe some of the gold inside. Don't lust after her beauty in your heart. Don't let her take you with her eyelids. So always read that symbolically of the false system as well as physically of some woman other than your mate. By means of a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. Of course, here again, the word for life is soul. So the whorish woman hunts for the soul. Can a man take fire in his bosom? And the Greek verbs literally shovel up fire, like you're shoveling it up into a steam boiler or something. Can a man shovel up fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one go upon hot coals and his feet not be burned? So he that goes into his neighbor's wife, whoever touches her, shall not be innocent. Now that doesn't teach that it's okay if she hadn't already married. You know, this particular passage is only talking about a neighbor's wife, adultery. But what about these previous chapters we've been reading about? They haven't been talking about adultery. They've been talking about harlotry or fornication or any kind of involvement with any other woman other than your own mate. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. So, you know, you can't even alienate someone's affections without paying a penalty, whether you ever go all the way into the act of adultery or not. You know, some people think, well, we didn't really commit adultery. We didn't really commit fornication. Well, God says whoever touches her shall not be innocent. Men don't despise a thief if he steal to satisfy his soul. Now notice what thieves satisfy when they steal. They satisfy their soul. Well, how can that be any immortal essence that goes up to God and lives in heaven forever? When a thief is hungry, it's his soul that needs to be satisfied. So it's obvious here the word soul means your physical anatomy in a human system. Now, in the word despise, you get a little bit misled here because the Hebrew word literally means men will not think it a trifle or a little matter for a thief. In other words, they don't think it's unimportant. They don't think it's, well, don't worry about it or who cares. But it won't be as bad a feeling as if he violated something worse in comparison. If he be found, he'll restore sevenfold. Now, of course, men don't understand that you put all the Bible together to get the whole story. There's no contradiction. And yet some commentaries you'll read, they'll say, well, the old law said the penalty was fourfold. But some guys later didn't realize that, and one guy says five times you pay back, and some guy later said you pay back sevenfold, so they just didn't know what the old law said. Well, they did too. You know, the principle of the old law was, depending on how hardened the criminal had become, and if you catch him with the goods, he pays back double. If he's already gotten rid of them before you catch him, he pays back fourfold. But if it's something of far greater value that he stole, it would just show more professional, calloused, advanced thievery, and he'd pay back fivefold. And if he steals something that a man makes his living by, he'll have to pay back sevenfold. So there's no contradiction in the Bible. You add the whole Bible together, and then you get the whole picture. So even though men don't think it's just a little thing, if a man steals to satisfy his own soul, if he's found, he restores sevenfold. Even if he has to give all the substance of his house in order to restore the sevenfold. In fact, what if he gives all he has and it isn't even enough to meet the sevenfold? Well, then he and his wife and kids go to work for the individual until they've worked to pay off the sevenfold. So you remember Christ said that even in the New Testament. He'll give all the substance of his house, but whoso commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. So here he's contrasting how much more someone that commits adultery. If a thief, when he's hungry to satisfy his soul, is penalized that severely by humans, how much more so a man that doesn't really have that kind of a need? He's got his own wife. How can he justify going out and getting involved sexually with some other woman? If a thief is satisfying his hunger, and yet men would punish him with that kind of a payment, how much more someone that doesn't have any justification for going out and getting involved with another woman? He's got his own wife. So that's why it's called committing adultery with a woman lacks understanding. And of course, here the word is just, he lacks heart. He doesn't have character. He lacks will. He lacks character. He that does it destroys his own soul. So a thief, in order to satisfy, preserve his soul, and yet men punish him that way, well, how much more someone committing adultery, he's going to destroy his own soul. So you notice what it is that you destroy when you commit adultery with another woman other than your wife? You destroy your own soul. A wound and dishonor he'll get. His reproach shall not be wiped away. In other words, it's a kind of a mistake you can't undo. It's a kind of a sin God will forgive the penalty for it, but, you know, it'll always be there in your mind. And then God warns the reason. For jealousy is the rage of a strong man. The Hebrew word Geber again. Not just Ish or Adam, but jealousy is the rage even of the strongest man. No matter how much character and how much will and how much self-control any man can have, jealousy is a rage even of a strong man. Therefore, he won't spare in the day of vengeance, and he won't regard any ransom. Neither will he rest content, though you give many gifts. So it's a kind of a mistake that can't be undone. Now going on in chapter 7, another one of the My Son chapters. Another one about the strange woman and another warning on the subject of sex. My son, keep my words. Here again, the terminology means guard and watch over and hold like treasure. God's laws are like pearls you cast before swine. You treasure them. You grasp them, hang on to them. They're valuable to you. Lay up my commandments like you lay up treasure month to month or year to year. You lay up and keep my words and my commandments with you. And then he comes with the regular word for keep that means do or obey. Keep my commandments and live. So here again, life was promised, as Paul said, when you keep the commandments. But no man could keep them perfectly, so it wasn't eternal life. He that keeps them shall live in them. Keep my law as the apple of your eye. Now that's an interesting word. The Hebrew word literally means the little man of the eye, referring to the reflected image in the eye. In other words, your character shows through your eye. And so does demonism, or so does someone that's being brainwashed or empty-headed. The Greek word, they call it the little damsel of the eye. The Latins called it the little pupil in the eye. Pupa or pupilla of the same eye, and that's where we get pupil of the eye. So the word pupil literally means the being is reflected in their eye or through their eye. And interestingly enough, you find that Hebrew term six times in the Bible. Now, going on with chapter 7, verse 3, bind them upon your fingers. Write them upon the table of your heart. And here it's as if it were a signet ring, you know, that you bind them as if it's a signet ring on your fingers. You write them on the tablet of your heart. So notice that wasn't something new to the New Testament. They knew that was the purpose of God's laws way back there even, but not very many people had God's Spirit to do it with. You say to wisdom, you're my near kin. You call understanding, you're near kin. Your close friend or kin. They're dear to you like a kinfolk or a sister. That's the way you should look on wisdom and understanding. That they may keep you from the strange woman, from the stranger, which flatters with her words. And here, once again, Solomon uses the two opposite words for a strange woman. The first one meaning apostate, zur in the Hebrew, and the second one meaning alien or foreign. So God's words and commandments, God's commandments and law, keep you not only from the apostate woman, but also from the strange woman that flatters with her words. Now here he pictures how he looked out far at the window of my house. I looked through my casement or window shades or Venetian blinds or whatever you'd say in modern day English. Beheld among the simple ones. So you notice the term here is not rebel or warped by nature, but simple, no instruction, no warning. The Hebrew literally says, a boy without heart. I discerned among the sons, there the Hebrew word is sons, not youths, so this is another one of the admonitions to sons. I beheld among the simple ones, I discerned among the sons, a young man void of understanding. Void of heart, again, the Hebrew word, without character, without any previous training as to rights and wrongs or do's or don'ts. So it's not the picture here of a prodigal son, a rebel, a vicious, flagrantly stubborn one at all. It's simple. Someone untaught. And how many times, you know, you hear women when they find out a son or a daughter did evil and they say, well, boy, you know, they never heard any words like that from me, or, you know, they never heard the word sex mentioned in our house, and So the warning here is that very warning. People that aren't taught. The boy without a heart, without character, deficient in self-restraint or character, passing through the street. Now, really, the word street there means back street. So the picture is sneaky, you know, ashamed, hiding out, doing something in the dark, in the back alley, in the back street, near her corner. He sauntered up to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in other words, in the darkness of the evening of the day, in the black and dark night. The darker and the blacker, the more it's going on, you know. So he suggests it actually starts out at the going down of the sun and darkness begins and lasts all the way into the black and dark night. Behold, there met him a woman with the attire of an harlot. So apparently even then there was a way that you always knew what they were by the way they dressed, the attire they had on. And subtle of heart. And here the word literally is a Hebrew word that means hidden. They're deceptive and the real heart's hidden. And a false heart is expressed of understanding and sympathy and love and interest and totally misleading. Hidden of heart. She's loud and stubborn. So God says a woman of a meek and quiet spirit is of great price. Her feet abide not in her house. So Paul talks about a keeper home. And it apparently was an obvious contrast with this harlot woman here. So just the opposites are mentioned here as mentioned in the other scriptures. Now she's without, now in the streets, a busybody, never staying at home. Lies in wait at every corner. See, bold and aggressive. And so she caught him and kissed him, and with an impudent, hardened. The Hebrew word literally means hardened. So anybody that, you know, it always burns me up when Johnny Carson or somebody or someone's interviewing someone about a movie that talks about prostitutes. And here they talk about the oldest profession in the world. Now, where on earth did they get that? You know, that doesn't make sense. That's a big lie. That's not the oldest profession on earth. The oldest profession on earth, what God had Adam do, you know, dress and keep the garden. How did they get away with that kind of lie? And, you know, no matter how much of a harlot somebody is, to me it'd be kind of interesting if we had the old Bible laws, you know, and any of these Hollywoodites who've been with more than one man, we just say Harlot Jones and Harlot Smith. And, you know, how would you like to have them introduced that way on TV? You know, it might smash that glamour a bit and keep people from making goddesses out of them. But not only are they not talked to that way, they're even still miss. They've been married 8 times and they're miss. And they don't even have their husband's name. Well, that is ridiculous. Here she caught him and kissed him with a hardened face, said unto him, I have peace offerings with me. Can you believe that? Prostitute's got a cross around her neck. Horrors of horrors. Somebody can live like that and claim to be religious. That beats it all, doesn't it? I have peace offerings with me. This day I've paid my vows. Same day she's committing whoredom and harlotry, she's paid her vows. Therefore I came forth to meet you, diligently to seek your face, and I found you. As if she knew him by name and was interested in him as an individual, and all he was $50. He wasn't somebody individually, but she's hardened and she's got her hidden heart and she's loud and talkative. Diligently, I came out to seek your face, and I found you. I have decked my bed with coverings of tapestry, with carved works, with fine linen of Egypt. I've perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let's take our fill of love.
It sounds kind of like that song Frank Sinatra made famous, didn't it? About strangers in the night exchanging glances. Come, let's take our fill of love until the morning. Let's drink deeply. Let's solace ourselves with loves. Loves, loves, much love. Whirl with loves. For the good man is not at home. He's gone a long journey. He's taken a bag of money with him. So suggesting you don't have to worry about getting caught, you know, he's got a big bag of money and he's gone way off from home. A long journey. He'll come home at the day appointed, or a full moon or new moon, or the Hebrew just suggesting a definite time he's supposed to return. So with her much fair speech, she caused him to yield. With the flattering of her lips, she forced him. Now, maybe that's why God's law back in Deuteronomy said, if a man entices a maid, he'll surely endow her to be his wife. You know, it doesn't say if a maid entices a man, he'll surely endow her to be his wife. It says if a man entices a maid. Now, of course, that word maid is the word for virgin, someone that's pure and hasn't been touched before. But here, the woman is the aggressor. She's the oily, suave, persuasive, and yet hidden underneath that is a hard, calloused, not care. Now, if most people would teach their children all about this from the time they get in their early teen years, maybe people would learn that the hard way. And maybe people wouldn't talk about, well, everybody else got to sow their wild oats, how come I don't get to? As if it's something you're being deprived of. Now, you know, it's ignorance and stupidity. Well, what do you call it here? Simple. Uninstructed. Weak character. He labels it for what it is. With her much fair speech. Very talkative. Very out, you know, aggressive. Been around the track more than Seabiscuit, you know, and that's the way it describes her there, if you notice. He goes after her right away, straightway, as an ox. You know, an ox follows the owner thinking he's going to grain, and he leads him to the butcher shop and slices him in bits. But the ox doesn't know the difference when he's following the boss where he's taking him. Well, that's the way a man is. It goes into the woman like that. Or as a fool to the correction of the stocks. And, of course, here this word for fool is the word that literally means lax and careless. And, you know, it's not someone that's hardened or experienced. Till a dart strike through his liver as a bird hastes to the snare. And knows not that it's for his soul. So even a bird has a soul. When a bird hastes flying swiftly right into a snare, the bird didn't know that that snare was for his soul. Neither does the man know. Hearken to me now, therefore, O you sons. There again is the admonition. O you sons. But they miss the continuity of that word through the Proverbs and translated children here. Hearken, O you sons. Attend to the words of my mouth. Don't let your heart decline to her ways. Don't pay any attention to that much talk. Don't believe her. Why would you listen to someone like that? They'd lie. Don't let your heart decline to her ways. Go not astray in her paths. For she has cast down many wounded. Yea, many strong men have been slain by her. Would you believe men like Abraham, men like Joseph, men like Judah, Jacob, David? You talk about many strong men have been slain by her. And think of the wounded that the strange woman or the apostate woman has brought down. Her house is the way to hell. It's the quickest way to get there, you know. It's a straight shot right to hell from her house. Her house is the way to Sheol, going down to the chambers, her inner chambers. So there may be one place they got the idea that there are compartments in hell. Well, when you have people buried in caves, you've got a lot of different caves, all within one large cave. So if you've seen the way they bury the dead overseas, then you know what that means. There are many individual holes in the huge cave to stuff people in. There are many chambers in these underground sheols for people to be put into. So if she has cast down many strong men, what hope does a simple one have? What hope does a youth void of understanding have? When you think about it, sex is one of the biggest destroyers of man that there has been, and more in our day of women in addition. Now, back in the old days, you know, everybody was taught there's more for the man anyway, so it wasn't that big a factor with that many women. Now, in contrast to the sinful pleasure presented back there in chapter 7, under the type of an alluring, but the kind of a woman that's pictured there, now you get strong motives and the opposite, God's way. Wisdom, understanding, the law and commandments are personified as a she, as a woman. And yet pure and lovely and discreet and affectionate. So now you get a contrast with the strange woman. Chapter 8. Doesn't wisdom cry? And this particular word is just personifying wisdom. We read those words for wisdom back in the first chapter. This is the most common word. Wisdom cries. If you think and observe, if you study, you can see wisdom in Churchill or MacArthur or Harry Truman or a lot of people. Wisdom's crying out all the time every day if people would just be interested in pursuing wisdom rather than sensuality or physical. You know, we've got that satanic proverb in our day, if it feels good, do it. That is one of the most stupid things you could imagine. If it feels good, do it. Now that has to be right from Satan himself. Doesn't wisdom cry? Doesn't understanding put forth her voice? Aren't they just screaming all around if people will just take note and study and listen and note and observe? Now, if you had a message you wanted to deliver, you'd do exactly what he's going to describe wisdom doing here. So a messenger would go stand in the top of high places. He'd find the cross sections, the intersections. By the way, in the places of the paths, that's where you'd go. You'd go to the gates where everybody comes in and goes out of, at the entry of the city. You'd go by all the doors coming and going from the major buildings. Now, that's the way God says wisdom is like a crier, a messenger, going to all these strategic places to cry out wisdom. But who listens? Unto you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of man. Now here God uses the two words, ish, but he makes it plural. Ishim, the first word, men, and then Adam, sons of Adam, the next word. So he's classing everybody, all classes. No matter whether you're Ishim or Hadam, God cries, to you, O men, my voice is to the sons of Adam. O you simple, understand wisdom. So here's the continuity of the book. That goes all the way back to chapter 1 about the simple. It goes all the way back to the previous chapter about the simple. And it urges all to understand wisdom. Now this is a different word than the verse 1. So he's not just telling you you need to get one kind of wisdom, but you need to get all these kinds of wisdom. This word is harma, which means shrewdness. And you fools, and this is the word that meant fat, dense, stupid, you know, suggesting sluggishness of brain by volume of food or fatness in that sense. Be you of an understanding heart, hear, for I'll speak of excellent things, princely things. And the word things is really the word for words. Dabar, D-A-B-A-R. I'll speak of princely words, or top, first-class things, first-class words. The opening of my lips shall be right things. For my mouth shall speak truth, and wickedness, ratio, lawlessness, is an abomination to my lips. So anything that fosters from lawlessness, he'd regard as an abomination to his lips. That's too bad some men in the last 10 years didn't memorize that verse 7, because if they'd regarded lawlessness or rebellion as an abomination to their lips, well, maybe they wouldn't have fostered it, wouldn't have planned it and talked it and plotted it. All the words of my mouth are in righteousness. I'm not going to let my lips get involved with lawlessness. That's an abomination. It's especially dangerous and wicked. It's an abomination. There's nothing forward or perverse in them. They're all plain to him that understands, and right to them that find knowledge. Receive my instruction, and not silver. Receive knowledge rather than choice gold, because wisdom is better than rubies. It's interesting here, through the book of Proverbs, there are 17 places where God compares a spiritual thing as being better than a physical thing. 17 times he does that. Wisdom is better than rubies. All the things that may be desired, you know, prestige or long life or power or whatever they are, aren't to be compared to wisdom. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. And here, of course, he's likening it again, not to just the woman that he had, but now to a person or a being. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. So they, one leads into another and is a sister to another, and find out knowledge of witty inventions. The Greek parallel would mean to know intuitively, not by an effort, which would be genosko, to get to know, but this is just as if you have inherited intuitively. Find out knowledge and gain intuitive foresight or insight. The fear of the eternal is to hate evil. Now, that's quite an interesting thing, because I've known of people in the past that I thought were converted, and every day and every week and every month of their lives, they were always fighting themselves. They always wanted to go the way of sin and lust or covetousness, or every day, every week, every year, they're always fighting their nature, as if they just always desired and craved and wanted to be able to do the wrong. And yet, is that really the way somebody is when they're converted? Sure, you still have your nature there, and you're tempted. But is somebody really converted when they just have that never-ending love of evil, desire for evil? Well, that isn't what this verse says. This verse says if you really build and gain and develop the fear of the eternal, then you're going to get to where you're going to hate evil. And even if you're tempted and slip up and do it, you're going to hate it. You're not wanting to do it, and you're not glad you did it, and you're not always having to fight yourself. I've known of young people that grew up in the church. A couple of them I just read about on DNR cases in the last few days. And they always knew what was right, and they were dunked. And later, you know, they're just seemingly always going back out and then back in. And then they go out and they're back in, and they go out and they're back in. And well, that isn't what this verse says. This verse says if you ever gain or know and experience the fear of the eternal, then you hate evil. But, you know, by human nature, men love evil. Well, if you're converted, you should be committed to go the way contrary to evil. And even if it overtakes you and you slip up, maybe that's why Paul says in Galatians 6:1, even if a brother is overtaken in a fault, which just shows you know how it happens. Pride and arrogancy and the evil way. Do you hate that? If you have the fear of the eternal, then you hate pride because blessed are the meek. And when somebody's converted, they have a humility and a yieldedness like the Philippians had. So if you fear the eternal, you hate pride. If you fear the eternal, you hate arrogancy. Now you might think those are one and the same, but they aren't, you know. Arrogancy might have to do more with being sold on your abilities and your accomplishments and your life, and pride might have more to do with your intellect or your brain or your heredity. And the evil way. And the forward mouth. So here are four specific things God labels when He says God hates them all. And if you have the fear of the eternal, like God, you hate them all too. But if you've never been converted, by nature men love evil. And they're hostile and enmity against God. The forward mouth or perverse mouth I hate. So counsel is mine and sound wisdom. I'm understanding. I have strength. So here maybe in contrast to those four things God hates, instead of having those four things, you have counsel and sound wisdom, understanding and strength. By me, kings reign. Now, of course, you have to take that along with the other passages about kings ruling. And, you know, many other proverbs say if you find a king that's just and upright, then his people will be that way and he'll reign a long time. But if someone is especially evil, you know, he may not even reign a year. So the reign of a king may well hinge on the length of his reign as to far as how much he has God's wisdom or understanding. By me kings reign and princes decree justice. And that's the only way you can really know true justice is by God's laws. You know, when Mr. Armstrong says only through God's laws can man learn the two areas of his relationship that no human can learn any other way. You know, you can go and study psychology and study sociology and study anything else you want to about man, and you'll never get true justice out of a carnal mind. And you look at our court systems. Princes decree justice by God's wisdom. By me, princes rule, and nobles, all the judges of the earth. So any that are going to last very long and have a blessed reign are going to have wisdom and justice and understanding, and that's why God always had every king had to write him out a copy of the law, and he had to study in it every day so he could always be reminded of the balance of God's laws. I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. So if you want to have love back your way, then you love wisdom, and then wisdom will love you. It'll bless you. It'll protect you and prosper you and give you a long, happy rule. Riches and honor with me. Those are lasting and permanent and not just fleeting wealth of the wicked. Riches and honor with me. Durable riches. Ones that last. Ones that aren't temporary, that thieves and rust and moths devour, but durable riches, righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yea, than fine gold. My revenue is better than choice silver. Now, God continually harps on that because all men by nature have a thriving or a desire or pursuit of gold and silver and money and security and wealth and prosperity, and yet the spiritual things are far more important than that. Wisdom and knowledge and understanding and love. And I lead in the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of judgment, that I may cause those that love me to inherit substance, and I'll fill their treasures. The eternal possess me. Now, after he urges man, personified as a person, I'll love you, you know, I'm wisdom, let me dwell with you. I dwell with prudence. So beginning in verse 12 through verse 21, he's trying to urge men to recognize the place wisdom has played in prosperity and success and lasting values above other kings and wealth. And now he begins a new section showing you that wisdom is something even God himself had. So it isn't just something that man should desire or could have, but it shows how much God possessed it from the very beginning. And of course it emanates out from God and began with God and is increased by God. The Eternal possessed me in the beginning of His way, before His works of old. So before Genesis 1, before the angels were put down, wisdom, God possessed it and used it before His works of old. I was set up from everlasting from the beginning, or ever the earth was. So even way back before spirit beings were even put on the earth, the angels, from everlasting wisdom was set up from the beginning, or ever the earth was, when there were no depths. Way back in Genesis 1:1, when there were no depths, wisdom was brought forth. When there weren't any fountains of the deep that broke out and sent the floods, when there were no fountains abounding with water, wisdom was there. Before the mountains were settled, and here, of course, he's telling you how God established the mountains firmly and permanently and strongly, before the hills I was brought forth, before God made the hills and the valleys and the mountains and moved the water back into the holes and let dry land appear, while as yet he hadn't made the earth nor the fields, before he let the earth come through that layer of water that was there in the flood that totally encompassed the earth from Satan's rebellion, while as yet he hadn't made the earth, hadn't caused it to come through the waters, nor the fields, nor the highest part of the dust of the world. When God finally let the waters assuage to where there was mountains sticking up through, the highest part, when he prepared the heavens, wisdom was there. When God set a compass upon the face of the depth, so when you got down to the bottom of that layer of waters that covered the earth, there was a circle there, an orb, a circumference. When he established the clouds above, God did that by wisdom, where they'll hold enough water till they get too much, and then down it comes, and then the sun's rays, you know, draws the water back out of the lakes and then up into the clouds, and God established the clouds above. When God strengthened the fountains of the deep, when God gave to the sea His decree that the water shouldn't pass His commandment, thus establishing the boundaries of all the countries that He put the peoples in. When God appointed the foundations of the earth, He did all that by wisdom. Then wisdom was by Him as one brought up with Him. Wisdom was daily the delight of the Creator. He always rejoiced in wisdom, rejoicing in the habitable part of His earth. My delights were with the sons of men, the sons of Adam. Now therefore hearken to me, O you sons. Now here again, you lose that story flow of the message being to young people and children and sons by the bad translating. Now therefore hearken, see, after he's shown you how even God treasured wisdom, even God rejoiced always with wisdom. God daily delighted in wisdom, as if it were one of his children. So now after he shows you in those intervening verses about verse 22 on through 30, how God used wisdom and treasured it, and now he comes back to man again and admonishes man as to how he ought to be interested in wisdom. Now therefore hearken to me, O you sons, for blessed are they that keep my ways. So if you keep the ways of wisdom, then the blessings come your way, the happinesses. Now apparently instead of the things God hates and the abominations, the blessed things come in contrast to that. Hear instruction and be wise and don't refuse it. So you notice again the perpetual problem of man is getting another generation to listen to a previous generation. That's one of the most unexplainable impossibilities that exists. Why won't one generation ever listen to another one? But you notice that's shown through the book of Proverbs as being, they knew about it. They knew that was so. They indicate that over and over because they show how from the very first chapter, man didn't want any of God's instruction. He set aside God's teaching. And he continues to say that. Don't refuse it, verse 33. Don't refuse instruction and wisdom. Blessed is the man that hears God or hears wisdom, that watches daily at wisdom's gates, that waits at the post of wisdom's doors, because whoever finds wisdom finds life and shall obtain favor of the eternal. But he that sins, here again misses the mark against God, wrongs his own soul. Now you notice again the degrees of sin. When somebody misses the mark, it's never branded an abomination. It's never branded as one of the despicable things that you're almost going to burn in a hell for. It's always just the way people do. They miss the mark, even when they're converted. But he that misses the mark against me wrongs his own soul. All they that hate me love death. Now, they may never recognize that and admit that, but that doesn't change the fact.